Once more this evening, we turn to the book of the Revelation, chapter 13, verse 1b through 10. Our subject is the Antichrist, segment number 7. In the history of mankind, many political leaders have dreamed of ruling over a worldwide empire. This was tried by the Egyptians, it was tried by the Assyrians, it was tried by the Babylonians, it was tried by the Medo-Persians. The Greeks under Alexander the Great tried it. The great Roman Caesars tried it. Napoleon tried it and scared the world half silly. Mussolini tried it and Hitler tried it. These all, however, found that their conquests fell short of world domination. No leader has ever ruled over Europe, Asia, and Africa, which are centered around Israel, let alone the Western Hemisphere, North and South America, North, Central, and South America. All attempts in the past at world government have indeed fallen short of that goal. Now, the world today is in effect smaller than it used to be due to instant satellite communication, to the rapid means of travel from one place to another, for the fact of ballistic missiles which are able to target any place on the face of the earth, and for the computer control of world finances. The result is that nations are no longer isolated from one another as they were in the past, so they are affected by what happens around them. The nations of the world now have, in fact, an increasing economic interdependence. Current American policy is now seeking, you may have followed in the news recently, to establish a free trade arrangement between the United States and Mexico, which means that there won't be any duty, there won't be any penalties, there won't be any cost to producing something with cheap labor in Mexico and selling it up here in the United States at considerable profit. The United States has this kind of an arrangement now with Canada, and the reasoning behind the American government in doing this is to try to create a trading bloc which has the power to compete with the United States of Europe, which I remind you again comes into existence January 1, 1993. Then it becomes one country, no more borders, one parliament, one government, one currency. It is a united force, one military structure, and it will be the greatest, the most powerful economic, military, and every other direction force in the world at that time. The United States will indeed be eclipsed. Japan recently has declared that it no longer fears the United States. It no longer is concerned about keeping the United States happy in order for trade to be carried on between us and the Japanese, because we are now no longer the primary trading partners of Japan. Asia now trades far in excess of anything that the Americans do, and what Japan has, the Americans need. So here again is another one of those little elements indicating the factors that are going to be involved in the removal of the United States from being a world power, in addition to those we mentioned this morning. Governments, in their human viewpoint, furthermore, have promoted the human good of socialism under the guise that it's a good thing for people to have what they need, and the way to do that is to share the wealth of the world. What has happened is that expectations of people who don't have anything have been so raised that now they are demanding, as non-producers, the fruits of the labors of the producers of capitalist societies. Once you tell a person he has a right to have something he doesn't have that somebody else has, it is very easy for him very quickly now to decide to put some muscle behind what he feels he deserves. And if you won't give it to him, then it is no problem for him to see justification in simply taking it away from you, either by stealing it surreptitiously or by violence. That has now become the norm in our society. Governments find that they cannot raise taxes high enough to satisfy the greed of the indolent that they have raised. These unsatisfied demands are leading to violence, and is tearing the social structure of all nations on the face of the earth. Socialism always creates shortages, and it reduces a nation's ability to produce food, so that countries which should be extremely prosperous and independent, self-reliant, can't even feed themselves because of the political, economic climate which has been created. People are increasingly, therefore, going to be looking for some strong man on the world scene to exercise political power because they are now fearful for their very survival. Add to this the threat of nuclear weapons in the hand of irresponsible fanatics like Saddam Hussein, and fear is created in all nations. You may be sure that in the recent Gulf War, if Hussein had had nuclear weapons, he would have used them. There are some genuine environmental problems, pollution, abuse, and destruction that is being used to justify the call for more government controls over people. There is a lot of bunko on environment, such as the greenhouse effect, that the world is getting warmer and that this is going to create a disaster. There's a lot of false environmental issues, but there are some genuine ones. But in any case, the whole point is government has to come into the picture in order to control people. Lawlessness and immorality are raising also the cry for more government by people who are victims. And what more government always does is restrict the personal freedom of the citizens of the nation. The people of the world are increasingly receptive, therefore, to this idea of a new world order that is a world government, and very logically that should be under the United Nations. Today, this kind of a world government is technologically possible. The groundwork, furthermore, has been set by international bankers and politicians who for several decades have been working behind the scenes to create a socialist world and a one-world government. God has prevented the fruition of their plans up to now. He has interrupted their best efforts from the time of Nimrod at the Tower of Babel with his plan for international one-world government to the current David Rockefeller of Chase Manhattan Bank and the head of the Council of Foreign Relations and of the Trilateral Commission, two organizations, international and national, which are devoted to creating a socialist world and a one-world government in which the bankers and the politicians will be the behind-the-scenes shadow government who runs things and who will reap enormous profits from that kind of a world. Well, the truth is that God will permit this dream of world government to be realized in the tribulation under the Antichrist. And we looked at that this morning as we saw that John observes that one of the heads of the beast that he saw, these heads that represent world empires, had a wound that appeared mortal. But instead of the head dying, it was healed. And that refers, because the heads represent governments, represents the Roman Empire, which for some 1,500 centuries, which for some 1,500 years, has seemingly been politically dead. This Roman Empire is going to be restored or healed in the form of a 10-nation confederacy of European nations. The Antichrist will become the new Caesar, and the empire head which John saw bearing a seemingly mortal wound will be healed. The Antichrist will possess such an awesome military arsenal that he will be feared as once were the emperors of Rome. The United Nations and those who promote the United Nations have always wanted such a military force to exist in the hands of an international organization in order to police the world and to enforce its resolutions. The international one-worlders actually want to merge the American and Soviet military power and to put it under the neutral control of a third party. That third party will be the shadow government of bankers and political leaders who will then have at their disposal the world's smart weapons. They will be invincible. They will be the real rulers of mankind. Once the nations of the world are disarmed, Satan will be ready to establish his world empire and government of the Antichrist. It is very important, if you're going to be a tyrant, that you do not allow people to have guns. Tyrants are always discouraged by guns in the hands of their victims. And what are we hearing today? People in Congress, those human viewpoint men that always get into office, are falling all over themselves trying to figure out how to impose more restrictions on Americans owning their personal weapons. Tyranny, read the handouts today, always is based upon restricting people from having a means to resist an aggressive tyrannical government. Well, Satan eventually will have the gun laws in place. Satan eventually will have everything under control so that the Antichrist will be able to come on the scene with such a military force and such power that all the world will yield obedience and allegiance to him. They will follow his New Age occultic religion as well. The Roman emperors always connected political power with their personal deity. That's why as you look at old Roman coins, you will see the image of the emperor of the time on the coin, but underneath it you will also see the declaration that he is deity. The Antichrist will control all the commerce as the world ruler, and he also, like the emperors of old Rome, will declare himself to be God. You see, it will be a very small step from global banking, which we have today, laser scanning of barcodes, which we have today when you go to the store to buy anything, computer records, which we have today. It will be a small step from all that which is in place and has become almost commonplace to us now to a condition that requires a mark on your person to buy and sell. It'll be a small step to go from that magnetic strip which is on your credit card that tells them all kinds of information about you when you use it and keeps a track of what you do with it, to the use the credit cards that you use in money machines. It'll be a very small step from that to the mark of the Antichrist as an unseen laser tattoo on your right hand and on your forehead that can be scanned, just like the grocery store scans the items that you buy. Or the latest thing, a little microchip that's almost invisible to the human eye, easily shot under the skin, implanted, that can keep track of reams of information about you. The time will come when people are going to have some kind of a mark like that on their person, and they will not be able to buy a sack of groceries unless they can run that under the scanner, or their foreheads can be read, and the Antichrist has approved the transaction through the computer controls. You can go anywhere in the world with the plus system of funding. Machines are centrally controlled by satellite hookups, and you can use your card to draw money. Unless somebody puts into the computer, don't respond to this card. The Antichrist will be the world's military, religious, and financial leader with undisputed control over all the world, and people will view him as the greatest genius that has ever lived. At that time, Satan will finally have what he's always wanted. A man fully dedicated to himself, fully dedicated to Satan, a man who will now be in a position to control the whole world and who will obey Satan implicitly. Anyone who opposes the will of the Antichrist will be exterminated in the style of communist leaders today. It is interesting to observe that even the Muslims now will be ready to accept the Antichrist as the final prophet of God. They are one group that we would expect would dig in and resist somebody like the Antichrist calling himself God. But you see, the recent Gulf War has had some great divine purposes behind it. It was obvious that one of those divine purposes was to exalt the United Nations and to give it a new sense of dignity and of acceptance and power throughout the world as a base for this world government concept. But there is something else that you should understand that is taking place in the Muslim world now. Because the recent Gulf War exposed something about Islam that the Muslims, if they ever were willing to face it, did not want to become public knowledge. The Gulf War has exposed the fraudulent claims of Islam. The leading Muslim country is Saudi Arabia. There in Saudi Arabia are to be found both Mecca, the most holy city, and Medina, the second most holy city of Islam. These holy sites had to be defended from other Muslims in the form of Saddam Hussein, had to be defended by, of all things, infidel Americans, or that country would have been overrun. And yet, it is the basic doctrine of Islam that Allah will always protect those who are devoted to Him. He will always protect His followers against those who would attack them. Yet it didn't happen. There has been a curtain, like the Iron Curtain that you know about in Eastern Europe, the Bamboo Curtain that you know about in the Orient, separating the communist world from the free world, so that people who are on the communist side of those curtains have been kept in the dark about what happens on the other side and how great things life is on the other side. There has been also a Muslim curtain, a curtain made of Muslim, we may say, perhaps. This curtain has also kept information from the followers of Islam about what's out there on the other side in the world that they call the infidel world. They have been out of contact with the Christian world. They have been shielded from the West, so that they've had a lot of distortions, mistaken ideas. Thoughtful Muslims now are asking themselves some questions about what has happened through this Gulf War. They have been told, and they believe sincerely, that they have the true religion of God. But now they're wondering about that, and some of them are beginning to dare to say it out loud. They're asking themselves such questions as, why did Muhammad choose the chief idol of the pantheon of idols which were worshipped by the desert tribes of Arabia? Why did he choose the chief idol whose name was Allah to be the God of Islam? Many Muslims don't understand that. They're not aware of the fact that Muhammad swept in there, came on this site of the shrine of the idols, filled with many idols, and that he threw them all out and he selected the one called Allah, which was the chief idol that the Bedouin tribes worshipped, an idol god, and he called this the true God, Allah. And as we know, behind every idol god there is a spirit of a demon. They're asking the question, why did Muhammad retain that black stone in the Kaaba shrine? This Kaaba was the shrine where the idols that the Bedouins, the nomads, worship were placed. This shrine in Mecca carried this black stone. This black stone, Muhammad said, was given by the angel Gabriel to Abraham. When the Muslims pray, they always face east to face the Kaaba, the shrine. Why did Muhammad keep this black stone, which the Muslims kiss today, when it was so prominent in the idol worship before he came on the scene? Furthermore, why did Muhammad teach that Islam was to be spread by killing those who refused it? Muhammad himself conducted 27 campaigns of slaughter, and I mean bloody slaughters. Anyone who refused to be converted to Islam was killed on the spot. And the Quran teaches that that's what you should do with infidels. What does it produce? You have the bloody, terroristic people of the Arab world. These people seem very crazy and odd to us, But you must remember that they are the direct products of the teaching of Muhammad. Some more thoughtful members of the Arab world are wondering, what kind of a God would be a God of slaughter and blood? They wonder about the claims that Allah will always protect and give victory to the Muslims. They found that that was quite false. The Muslims of Kuwait did not have victory. And if it had not been for the infidels of the West, Saddam Hussein would have also conquered Saudi Arabia. How could Muhammad claim that the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, were the true word of God, and that the New Testament Gospels were the true word of God, and then to say that the child of the promises to Abraham, who received the promises and passed them on to his posterity, was Ishmael and not Isaac? These Muslims are now beginning to think that Muhammad didn't know what was in the Old Testament. That is such an obvious statement, that Isaac was the child of promise and that Ishmael was definitely not the child of promise, and yet they've got it backwards. Thoughtful Muslims are saying, how could that be? Furthermore, they're saying, how could you accept the New Testament Gospels and claim that Jesus was not deity, to suggest that Jesus did not claim himself to be a God-man? They even wonder about a religion that claims to speak for God that treats women as cattle. You can have four wives as a Muslim, and you can divorce that wife simply by stating that she's divorced. All you have to do is say, I hereby declare that you are divorced, shove off baby. And you can replace her with a newer model that maybe is not so creaky and worn out. It's a very attractive system. Four wives, that's all. But no limitations on concubines. Girlfriends galore. Who would not be attracted in the lust patterns of the sin nature to such a religious system? And these thoughtful men are saying, what kind of a God of righteousness that we talk about would give us commands such as that? Such a brutal system as polygamy always is. And this is always Satan's mark through the religious systems of the world. That's why we know that Mormons, the greatest, most moral people on the face of the earth, are engrossed in a vile satanic religion, because their leader said, God said you should marry multiple wives. The world, including the Islamic world, is now ready technologically, socially, and emotionally for the Antichrist. And people really want a world government. How in the world did we come to that kind of a condition? There have been preparations for world government for decades. Where did it begin? The origin of the idea began as the result of World War I. It was called the League of Nations. And when I was growing up, I was in school, and we were taught about the League of Nations, the great peace organization of the world. Our President Wilson has said to the American people, we are going into World War I in order to make the world safe for democracy. And he called World War I the war that would end all wars. And he based that upon the fact that a union of nations would now prevent further wars. It was called the League of Nations. Americans were very quickly indoctrinated to the need for a world organization to preserve world peace in the future. Entrance into the League of Nations was strongly promoted by President Wilson. But we still had a biblical society, and we still had people being sent to Congress, to the Senate, who had to ratify treaties such as this, who were oriented to the Word of God. These discerning minds in the United States Senate realized that the League of Nations, in the nature of the case, would have to supersede the authority of the United States Constitution. That would undermine our national sovereignty and independence. So, after 9 long months of debate, 9 months of wrangling about this in the Senate, they voted against the United States joining the League of Nations. The people who were promoting world government were crushed. They drew their forces together and they said, we have to think this through. It was a great defeat. And what they did was proceeded to create organizations that would now start moving the government toward the concept of world unity by getting their members inside the American government. And an organization was formed which was called the Council of Foreign Relations. The Council of Foreign Relations today has literally hundreds of men in an organization that is maybe 1,200 people around the world. 1,200 people around the world. You have to be somebody really significant to be invited to join the Council of Foreign Relations. Something like 250, 300 are in the critical point positions of the American government today, especially in the State Department. And those people are constantly moving to acclimate the American mentality toward a one world government organization. President Bush himself was a very prominent, respected member of the Council on Foreign Relations until somebody began informing the American people during the Reagan election of what this organization was about, what its history had been, and the lid was blown, the cover was blown, and President Bush very quickly resigned so he could say, no, I'm not part of that terrible organization. With the attack on Pearl Harbor, which some knowledgeable American military and political men believe was deliberately maneuvered by President Roosevelt. In any case, with the coming of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States found itself in World War II. This now presented a new opportunity for the internationalists to incorporate the United States in a world government organization. In 1942, 26 nations gathered and they issued what was called the Declaration of the United Nations. This was the first use of the name of this new organization. The Allies agreed that following the war, they would form a world organization, and they did that in San Francisco, April 25 through June 26 in 1945. Interestingly enough, the chief leader of the American delegation to this forming conference of the United Nations was a man named Alger Hiss, who was subsequently exposed as a dedicated communist. While we were negotiating the structure of the United Nations, he was keeping his communist friends in the communist world informed on what was going on. President Truman expressed a willingness to have the United States place its military forces at the disposal of the United States of the United Nations without any approval of Congress. While it took 9 months to reject the League of Nations, it only took 6 days of debate in the Senate for the Senate to accept the entrance into the United Nations. That's how much change had come in the time between the wars. President Truman had to speak to the American people on this issue of the UN enforcing its rules, a world government that needs a military power, the same thing the Antichrist is going to have. And Truman said this, quote, it is this administration's contention that if the Senate ratifies the charter, that is the United Nations Charter, in the first stage, they accept a moral obligation to all other signatories of the San Francisco Charter to place at the disposal of the new organization an adequate supply of forces which will be available for use anywhere the Security Council, including the United States delegate, decides to send them, and note, without the authorization of the Congress in each case. For the first time in the history of American political life, a sitting president declared that Congress does not have to decide whether American military forces go to war, even though the Constitution says they do. This new organization was viewed as superseding the Constitution of the United States. United States senators who were approached about this, because there was a lot of furor over this, foolishly argued that they could control the use of American military forces by the United Nations leaders. A New York Times editorial the day after the Senate ratified the dream of a post-war superstate It entails the destruction of parts of the written Constitution without a by your leave to the American people. But that apparently is okay with Vandenberg and his cohorts. Senator Vandenberg, one of the leading proponents of accepting the United States into the United Nations. The New York Times said this, approvingly, the administration is also convinced that under Article 43, the United States has no moral right to stipulate that our forces shall operate in only one sector of the world or to demand that the Security Council hold up its decision pending approval of the U.S. Congress of the recommendation of the American delegates. Now, this is the kind of things that we were reading in the newspapers at the time, the people who were paying attention, and an organization into which our country was being drawn while we were being told by our leaders in Congress that they can have our military forces and Congress does not have to give its permission as to how they will be used by this world organization. The use of American military might by the UN became an issue 5 years later after we joined the United Nations. North Korea invaded South Korea, and immediately the United Nations turned to the United States and said, "We want your military forces," and President Truman placed our military at their disposal and sent men to Korea. When he was asked, "How can you do that without a declaration of war by Congress?" he said, "We are not at war. This is a police action. The United Nations Charter has the right to police the world with our forces." In our day, President Bush sent American troops into combat in the Gulf War under United Nations directorates. When people complained about this, and suddenly we're hearing on public television the debate, can the president send us into a full-scale war without the approval of Congress? The president argued that he did not need a declaration of war by Congress. He was implying this was a police action. It was not a war. But finally, to silence the opposition, he called for a joint resolution of Congress to authorize the use of American armed forces in Iraq. But he said, if they don't approve it, I can still do it. House Speaker Thomas Foley said that the resolution had the moral, that is the resolution of the United Nations calling for Americans to be sent to Iraq. Our Speaker of the House said the moral, legal, constitutional, practical consequences of... House Speaker Thomas Foley said that the resolution of the United Nations had, the quote, the moral, legal, constitutional, practical consequences of a declaration of war. The Speaker of the House said if the United Nations says go to war, that's the same as if our Congress had declared war. Now, a generation ago, you couldn't have gotten away with that. There had been such a furor in this country, it would have been unthinkable. Now, Americans are acclimated to world domination. They're acclimated to a world organization governing this nation. So the resolutions of the Security Council of the UN speaking for the international community sent Americans into battle in Operation Desert Storm. All of this was done to justify the United States acting as the world's policeman to establish the new world order, which is just what the Antichrist needs. It was amazing to hear the president use that term in view of what we know from biblical prophecy where the world is going. At the heart of a nation's sovereign independence is the right to control your own military forces. Both Truman and Bush justified sending Americans into war and to their deaths on the authority of United Nations resolutions, not on the authority of the United States Constitution. Most of the United Nations members, incidentally, sent no forces or very little to fight either in Korea or the Gulf War. It was an American operation all the way down the line. Now, the proponents of world government were delighted with the involvement of the United States in the UN wars, both in Korea and in Iraq. It enhanced the authority of the UN over the authority of the United States. General MacArthur, during the Korean War, and other American officers found that they were not permitted to defeat the communists in North Korea, but all they could do was merely push them back. It was not the objective of the proponents of world government to defeat socialism in any country. Therefore, there were established the rules of engagement. For example, you could not destroy an airplane on a North Korean airfield as long as it was on the ground unless it was trying to take off. You could not destroy a convoy truck if it was so many yards off the road. So when the airplanes came, all the convoys zipped off the road the appropriate distance and sat there and waved at the planes. As soon as they left, they got back on the road and started carrying their supplies. General MacArthur said that he was told by President Truman he could bomb half the bridges going across the Yalu River. The bridges going across from China, between North Korea and the Yalu River, separating from China. Supplies coming in, troops coming in. Suddenly at the end of that war, as a new war began, with the Chinese entering it, he was told he could only bomb the North Korean side of the bridge, half the bridge. And General MacArthur Riley said, "I have never been trained on a method by which one can bomb just half of a bridge." But yet that was right there in the rules of engagement. One of the officers in the airstrikes became so fed up with the fact that the communists were always waiting for the Americans in Korea when they came across, and he suspected it was because they were under United Nations authority, information going to the UN and the communists passing it on back to North Korea, that he ordered one of the greatest strikes and never told Washington he was doing it and didn't get the word to the United Nations, and it was a huge success. The communists were not prepared. And did he ever get reprimanded? And those of you who have been officers in the military know that a reprimand on your record is a very serious thing, especially if you're going to be a career officer. This man was reprimanded because he demonstrated what was happening in the information being given. So why would this country not want to defeat an aggressor like North Korea? Because the object is world government. If you don't understand that, all of this seems crazy. This has been in the minds of world leaders for a long time. President Abraham Lincoln, on one occasion, made an interesting observation to his law partner, William Hendon. Lincoln said to him, "The provision of the Constitution giving the war-making power to Congress was dictated, as I understand it, by the following reasons. Kings had always been involving and impoverishing their people in wars, pretending generally, if not always, that the good of the people was the object. This, our convention understood to be the most oppressive of all kingly oppressions, and they resolved to so frame the Constitution that no one man should hold the power of bringing this oppression upon us." That's exactly what was in the minds of the founding of the writers of the Constitution, to keep one man from being able to take people to their death in a war, as kings have done for centuries. The spirit for a powerful world government is increasingly attractive to Americans who know neither Scripture nor the meaning of the Constitution and have no idea where all this is leading us. So when in Revelation 13:3, we observe that one of these empires has been slain in the past, seemingly a fatal destruction, namely the Roman Empire, suddenly it comes full-blown back on the scene with a new Caesar in the form of the Antichrist. It is no wonder that the whole earth is amazed and is willing to follow the Antichrist, because he comes on the scene into a world which has already been prepared for world government, for the supremacy of one leader, for someone who can produce all of the things that people want government to do for them. When you understand this as your frame of reference from Scripture, then everything that we see taking place in our day is more impressive than ever. In verse 4, we see the ultimate result of this attitude on the part of people of the tribulation era. They respond in two ways to a world leader. They worship Satan, who establishes this world leader, and they worship the Antichrist himself. The details of that worship and the significance of this devotion to Satan and his beast ruler, we shall take up next time.